to the Ballyhoo Fiber Emporium, a podcast for fiber producers and artists. I'm your host, Madeline Norman. Today's show is geared mainly toward you producers, but hopefully our artist friends will learn a little about our battle with internal parasites. Although I'm going to discuss small ruminants and camelids, much of this information applies to your pets as well. Horses, dogs, cats, pretty much all living things suffer from parasites. Today's show is brought to you by Snyder's Spindles. These gorgeous little spindles of all varieties are handmade by Scott Snyder in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Scott knows the value of a well-balanced spindle as he does spin himself. He was most recently at Rhinebeck, so jealous. But if you missed him there, you can find Snyder's Spindles on Etsy or at snydersspindles.com. He's also on Facebook and he has an adorable guinea pig. I'm going to depart from the norm for a minute and share the news from Ballyhoo Farm first. Last Saturday, I attended the annual producers meeting of the Kentucky Sheep and Wool Producers Association. It was a great event, well attended, and well run by Kelly Yates. Thank you, Kelly. Guys, I have another confession. I got there early and literally sat in the car for like half an hour before forcing myself to go inside. I have horrible social anxiety, and I'm not even sure why. It's like battling a troll to get myself to interact, but then when I do, it's almost always a great experience. And all these folks love the same animals I do. Well, maybe not the goat guys. And I was voted onto the board of directors. I don't mind public speaking. I love it, actually. I love educating people. I enjoy getting to know them. The introduction, the just getting into the swing of an event, is brutal. So anyway, I got there and I set up my vending table, which was right by the entrance. I handed out a ton of brochures about the farm and much Ballyhoo fiber got fondled. Wool tends to be underrepresented in the association, so I really enjoyed bringing it front and center, both with my display and by spinning all day. Even two skeins of Ballyhoo handspun found a new home. Most people had never seen a drop spindle in action, and even fewer had seen someone spin while carrying on a conversation. One guy took my picture. He told me he was going to make me famous. I thought, well, that's already happened. I mean, the picture, not the fame. I met my mentees, and they are both fabulous ladies, and I enjoyed talking to them very much. I can't wait to work with them some more. I also sat and talked with the Crawleys, the couple who inspired the episode about getting started in sheep, so it was nice to put a face to that email. And I met a fellow producer who has long wools. I may abandon my own farm and go live amongst the Border Lesters and Wensleydales. I'll rock them to sleep at night, just stroking their locks. So one of the presentations given was by Dr. Beth Johnson, who is a state vet here in Kentucky. Since I was already planning to tackle the topic of internal parasite management, and she handed out pretty much the same outline I was creating, I'm going to take that topic and build on it. The most common internal parasites in fiber animals, again, small ruminants and camelids, I'm not going to cover yaks or possums or dogs here, are the HOT complex, Homuncus contortus, which is the barber pole worm, Ostertagia, which is the brown stomach worm, and Trichostrongylus, the bankrupt worm, so-called because it will drive you out of business. We also have a tapeworm, the lungworm, Imeria, which is coccidiosis, and bear with me, Paralephostrongylus, the meningeal worm, which afflicts goats and alpacas. And then we also have liver flukes, which are a type of flatworm. Let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. When you read, you begin with ABC. When you worm, you begin with HOT. HOT? The first three worms just happen to be... Sorry. Okay, seriously, let's discuss the life cycle of nematodes. These are roundworms, nasty little buggers. They have complex life cycles. The eggs are passed in animal feces, and it's here that the first two stages of larval development occur. In the third larval stage, the worms climb 2 to 4 inches up grass blades into a water droplet where they're consumed by grazing animals. Hundreds or even thousands of these things climb into the droplet. One drop of water. You can Google image search it. It's beautiful, horrific, and fascinating. Larval stages 4 and 5 develop within the host, and when the adult emerges, it produces eggs, which are passed in feces, and the cycle begins again. Lungworms are similar. The eggs are laid in the bronchi and the lungs, and coughed up, then swallowed by the animal, who passes them in feces. Here the larvae develop to an infective stage, are ingested during grazing, and develop in the intestines. Adults migrate to the mesenteric lymph glands, mesenteric means middle, and then travel to the lungs by surfing the bloodstream. Again, cough, cough, swallow, poop, and repeat. Are we seeing a pattern? Our mortal enemy, meningeal worm, ups the ante by involving extra hosts. Now it's a party. So there's a deer walking through the woods, and it eats a snail. The meningeal worm larvae inside the snail migrate to the deer's spinal cord. Adults go into the dura mater of the deer's brain and lay eggs, which migrate to the deer's lungs and hatch out as larvae. Like lungworms, the larvae are coughed up, swallowed, and passed in fecal matter. There on the ground, they encounter and infest the hapless snail. Now the process in the wild repeats. But what if the snail gets into your pasture? If you have goats or camelids, llamas and alpacas, and they eat the snail, the larvae migrate to the spinal cord. However, unlike deer, they stop there and paralysis occurs. And then you have a sad goat. Coccidiosis is a fun critter. It has a simpler life cycle than lungworms and meningeal worms, but it's nasty nonetheless. Expect runny stool, even bloody diarrhea. Death can occur if not treated, and no one needs that. We in the U.S. are fortunate not to have much issue with liver flukes, which are a member of the flatworm family. This, however, is the dread nemesis of producers across the U.K. It's endoparasitic, meaning it attaches itself to the host inside via its ventral sucker. It doesn't have an actual mouth, and it sucks the poor sheepsies dry. It's an awful bugger, and it can wipe through a flock the same way barber pole wipes through us here. With all these parasites, you can expect anemia, lethargy, diarrhea, loss of appetite, weight loss, lowered production, and itchiness. None of that is very pleasant. The very worst offender is homuncus, the barber pole. So called because thousands attach themselves to the intestinal wall, release an anticoagulant, and kill the sheep through blood loss. The infestation is bad enough, but the anemia raises the stakes to a critical level. Literally, guys, you can lose animals overnight. The trouble with sheep is they don't show signs of illness until they're at death's doorstep. It's critical to keep a watchful eye on your flock during the hot, wet season and to know what constitutes normality for your animals. If you must act, you do not have a moment to lose. Two summers ago, I decided to add Icelandics to my flock. I asked for records. I checked the sheep. I brought them home and tried to quarantine them, but Sam knocked down a fence and soon the two groups were mingling. I kept a close eye on them for a few weeks and all appeared well. This was probably in early May. As soon as I relaxed, the weather got hot and rainy. It was mid-June. Lambs were about a month or two old. One day I got a call that Shofra, a black ewe lamb, had collapsed and died. We thought it was from overheating. Then one of the ram lambs went down. He had a cough. We treated him for pneumonia and worms, but he died. My favorite ewe, one of the new Icelandics, was fine one day and dead the next morning. Now, none of these had the classic symptom of bottle jaw. None of them. They all looked perfectly fine. I wormed everyone, then wormed them again a week later. But more sheep went down, and now they were starting to show signs of bottle jaw. No matter what I did, they died. And by fall, I'd lost half my flock. Guys, I dug a grave every day. I treated hardcore. I'm talking wormer, apple cider vinegar, molasses. I gave iron shots. Some of them rallied four or five times, only to die. It was miserable. I literally sat on the ground and cried and said that if one more sheep went down, I was taking the rest of them to the butcher. I couldn't handle it. Barber pole women can produce 5,000 eggs per day each. 5,000 per female worm. Every day, inside your sheep. It's about 3 weeks from the time of infestation until the time those eggs start to hatch, and then they hatch on a weekly basis. Though they have a short life cycle, they thrive in warm and wet climates, so April to October in the Midwest and Southeast. Goats may acquire partial immunity, but immunity is slow to develop in sheep. But we're safe if we deworm, right? I mean, that's what they tell us to do, right? In days of yore, yes, that's what was recommended. Wormers were touted as effective, cheap, safe, broad spectrum. They'll kill anything if only you use them every 4 to 6 weeks as directed. Every animal, every time. But no new drug classes have been introduced since 1981, and in the meantime, the parasites have become resistant to the point that we're experiencing total anti-anthelminic failure. Resistance occurs when a drug is used, but for some reason, not all the parasites die. The same thing is happening with crops and insects. So we're spraying crops, but the insects aren't dying. That's because those who remain after the killing agent has been applied breed offspring who become increasingly immune to all the drugs in that class. As host animals are bought and sold, they spread resistant worms to their new flocks. And generally, at least with pesticides, our answer has been to use increasingly harsher chemicals. But at some point, that causes death in the host animal as well. Since 2005, small ruminant losses of 17 to 20% have been reported due to total anti-anthelminic failure. At that rate, we can't continue to raise these animals and expect to keep them healthy. The biggest contributor to resistance is a lack of refugia. As Dr. Johnson put it, refugia is the proportion of the parasite population that is not selected by the drug treatment. In other words, worms living in untreated animals, as well as eggs and larvae in the pasture. Now, this population carries wormer-sensitive genes, thus diluting the resistant gene pool. If you can effectively remove 50% of the worm load from your flock or herd, you will notice an improvement, but it's not going to last. What good are animals that have to be constantly treated in order to maintain? Animals whose parasite loads prevent them from thriving? Not much. So, in order to boost refugia, what do we need? Populations of animals with sensitive worm loads, populations who are themselves parasite resistant. This doesn't mean that they're immune to contracting parasites, but that their particular morphology allows them to maintain well-being with a parasite load under normal conditions. Now, around breeding time, when they're heavily pregnant, when they're lactating, or of course, if you're young or very old, those are times of particular stress. That doesn't constitute a normal condition, and you should definitely apply extra caution at those times. When you do treat the parasite-resistant animals, only treat the ones who show signs of needing drugs. Thrifty, lethargic, poor-producing, anemic, with diarrhea. You know the symptoms. For barber pole, we use Fumacha to tell. For everything else, you can run a fecal sample. Now, that's beyond the scope of this podcast, but you can certainly look it up. I drenched my flock earlier this week. First, I withheld food for over 12 hours. Not only did this make them super eager to run into the catch pen when I shook the grain scoop, it's a critical component of strategic deworming, working with the host animal's physiology to maximize drug efficacy. With nothing else in their systems, the sheep's digestive flow slows. So the drug works through the system slowly, really getting in all those nooks and crannies and cleaning out every last dirty worm. Second, I checked every sheep's condition and eyelids with Fumacha to determine whether or not they needed treatment. Of the girls, less than a quarter got wormed. The boys had a higher rate because I'm extra careful with lambs and there were a lot of boys this year. But of the adult males, only one was treated. Now, when I was growing up, not only did we worm horses religiously, every 4 to 6 weeks, and rotate classes of drugs, building resistance to multiple classes at the same time, we immediately turned them into new pasture. That's exactly the wrong thing to do, because the animals drop infected feces on the clean pasture and contaminate it. Keep them on dry lot or old pasture for a day, then move them after their intestines are cleaned out. Keep your pasture between 4 and 6 inches high if you can. Easier said than done, I know. And keep feet off the ground. Now that's one thing I'm not good at. We all have room for improvement. Keep water buckets and troughs up high enough that animals can't poop in it. If one water droplet can carry hundreds of homuncus, how many eggs do you think one fecal pellet can drop in a bucket? Now that said, ascarids, which are a certain class of worm, if you go outside and dig 1 square meter of ground, anywhere, no matter whether it's had animals on it or not, you can find up to 1 million or more ascarids. You're never going to get rid of all the parasites. It's a fact of life. We all have them. Well, I mean, hopefully we don't all have them. But all the animals you have outside, they carry a parasite load all of the time. It's not an issue unless they overwhelm the system. I expect to get a ton of questions about FEMACHA. I'll try to find a link for the show notes, which will probably not make it up until tomorrow at this point. It's pretty late. I've had a lot of homework. FEMACHA is pretty simple, but it's really only an effective test for barber pole. I also expect questions about natural dewormers. Since World War II, we've become a society that believes increasingly in technology over common sense. But science and technology are beginning to fail in comparison with the traditional farming methods that worked with nature. Ultimately, nature is best. Experts will tell you that there's not enough empirical evidence to support diatomaceous earth, apple cider vinegar, pumpkins and other squash, chicory, botanicals, garlic, etc. In my experience with my flock, diatomaceous earth and apple cider vinegar haven't made a noticeable difference. My sheep do consume bark steadily through the summer, and there are studies that show tannins to be effective against parasites. Most notably, every fall for a number of years, I have flushed all my animals, sheep, horses, chickens, the lot, with pumpkins and squash. These have a cleansing effect and are a food source that they'll seek out on their own if, for instance, pumpkins are growing in the pasture. I don't offer any further dewormer, and my flock does fine. In fact, the only season in which I do use chemical dewormers is late spring through early autumn, the season of the barber pole, and I only use Safeguard, because that's what works right now. That's what I do. It may not be what's right for your flock. You have to know your animals and parasite pressure and make your own determination. But do rotational graze. Do FEMACHA. Run chickens with your flock to break up fecal matter. Run cows and sheep or horses and sheep together. Their parasites are different. And lastly, refugia, refugia, refugia. Let's keep raising healthy fiber flocks for many years to come. Science class dismissed. Whew, that was a long one. And there's not even a quiz. You're all winners. So for latest and greatest, Bricks and I spent last Thursday dyeing yarn for the Chalette kits. We will be putting those out pretty soon. 1 dozen luxury kits. The yarns are hand-dyed silk cashmere blends in exclusive colorways, and we are so thrilled with the results. They're super pretty. There's one in particular. I wanted to call it Malabrego Eat Your Heart Out. It's gorgeous, and I wanted to keep it all for myself, but Brick said no. We have to share. You're going to want to get one. Trust me. All that remains is to take a few glamour shots, and we can put it up in the Emporium. I am also pleased to announce that we will have upcoming sock kits, which will include not only exclusive colors, but exclusive matching themed project bags by Terry Schmidt. If you don't know Bags by Terry, you will after next week. He gave me the privilege of his first ever interview, and it was so much fun. I can't wait to share, and I definitely can't wait to meet him in person. He has to come visit. I might have to go to Houston and drag him up here. Today's penny candy giveaway comes from Scott Snyder of Snyder's Spindles. I don't have a picture of it up on the site yet, but I will soon, I promise. Just let me get through this test tomorrow in international political economy. It's a lovely 1 ounce Turkish drop spindle, handmade and waiting for you to spin up some great yarn. Thank you again, Scott, for this oh so generous toy. As an added bonus, I'll be throwing in a couple of ounces of Ballyhoo Roving to get you started, and you can even pick the color. To enter the giveaway, all you have to do is leave a comment or question on the show notes page of the Ballyhoo Fiber Emporium site at ballyhoofiberemporium.com. Thank you again to Dr. Beth Johnson for her wonderful presentation at the Sheep and Goat Producers Annual Meeting last Saturday. Thanks as well to Scott Snyder of Snyder's Spindles. You can see pictures of his magnificent handmade spindles on Etsy or at snydersspindles.com. Remember, you can find show notes, comment, read more about FEMACHA and parasite management, and more at ballyhoofiberemporium.com, but not until Thursday, because I have a big test. You can follow Ballyhoo Fiber Emporium on Facebook or Instagram at Ballyhoo Fiber Emporium. Or join the fun on Ravelry in the Ballyhoo Fiber Emporium group. If you've liked what you've heard today, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Podcast Republic. I'm always looking for talented people in the fiber industry to interview, fabulous prizes to give away, and fiber businesses who would like to become sponsors. If any of these sound like you, visit the contact page of the Ballyhoo Fiber Emporium website. Have a great week, and remember, spin everywhere.